Could Jesus Christ have been married?
Because what I have found is that women are pretty much invisible in the scriptures. They make up 1.1% of all the words spoken in the Bible are by women. And their stories are not very prominent. They're just not big players in the Bible. So I'm not sure she would have made it in there, because even when a woman is referenced, a wife, a mother-in-law in the New Testament, they are usually not even given a name.
That's Sue Monk Kidd. We talk with her about her novel, The Book of Longings. It's the story of a brilliant young woman who becomes the wife of Jesus Christ. Then we re-air our 2016 interview with Monique Morris about her book, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Christianity has always assumed that Jesus Christ was not married. But could that really be true of a man who lived in a time when marriage was a fundamental marker of adulthood? And if Jesus was married, what would his wife have been like? That question is at the heart of Sue Monk Kidd's wonderful new novel, The Book of Longings. It's a story of a young woman named Anna, rebellious and ambitious, with a brilliant mind and a daring spirit. At a time when women's longings for a life of their own are brutally suppressed, Anna is a secret writer of narratives about neglected and silenced women. Then she meets Jesus of Nazareth, and they fall in love. Yet Anna never gives up her dedication to her own voice, just as Jesus follows his passion for a new ethos of love and justice. Grounded in meticulous research, The Book of Longings is a compelling account of one woman's bold struggle to realize her potential while living in a time, place, and culture devised to silence her. Sue Monk Kidd is the author of four novels, including The Secret of Bees, as well as four works of nonfiction. Well, Sue Monk Kidd, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted.
This book, The Book of Longings, it's a story of Jesus' wife, and the idea to write a story about Jesus' wife is pretty audacious. You were supported by a quote by Virginia Woolf as you wrote this book. Tell us about that.
Yes, that quote sat on my desk for the whole 4.5 years I wrote the book. And it says, "Everything is the proper stuff of fiction." So I took, that as a permission slip from Virginia Woolf.
That's great. That's a pretty prominent and honorable permission then.
Right.
And the person I always remember is talking about needing a room of one's own.
Oh, yeah. That's a very important book to me. And I highly agree with that. Everybody needs one.
Now, someone said to you that if Jesus had a wife, it would have been recorded in the Bible. What's your thought on that? Do you think Jesus did have a wife?
I have no idea, honestly. I do not go one way or the other. I mean, if I had to, somebody held a gun to my head and said, "What do you think?" I probably would say, "I think he probably did." But honestly, I don't know. I don't think anyone really knows. When someone said to me what you just quoted, that we would know about it because it would have been written about, my first thought was, really? I'm not sure about that. Because what I have found is that women are pretty much invisible in the scriptures. They make up 1.1% of all the words spoken in the Bible are by women. And their stories are not very prominent, the presence of their stories. They're just not big players in the Bible. So I'm not sure she would have made it in there, because even when a woman is referenced, a wife, a mother-in-law in the New Testament, they are usually not even given a name. So maybe she would, maybe she wouldn't.
And why would you think, I mean, just historically speaking, why would you think it's more likely than not that he would have been married?
Well, from my research, I found that Jewish men in first century Galilee were more or less required to marry from every standpoint, religiously, culturally, from their family, usually around the age of 20, though sometimes it could be a little older than that. This is how they took their place in the community, to become part of it. And God actually, in their scriptures, kind of commanded it. So that was a big deal. And I had no reason to think that he, you know, defied that. At that age, when he was younger, but long before he started his public ministry.
And you have pointed out that women actually had some real leadership in early Christianity. So why do you think the narrative that Jesus was celibate developed? I mean, you know, I'm not asking you to be a scholarly authority on the matter, but you've given it some thought.
I have. I did actually try to write about this a bit in an author's note that I placed at the end of the novel. And it is true that women had a much more prominent role in the early church in the first century, in those very first years. And it just went awry in the second century. There are all kinds of reasons and speculations about that. One of them is that a kind of Greek thought crept into early Christian formation about a dualism, I guess you'd say. And that dualism was about, you know, male and female and good and evil and spirit and secular. And so everything became at cross points, and women were on the devalued end of this, and they were associated with nature and the body, which was deemed inferior. And they just lost their leadership. And women in the known world really had that problem. So Christianity never really recovered from that until making strides in the last century.
You know, you could say that's where a whole lot of things may have started to go wrong when you think of the devaluation of the feminine and of nature and where we've ended up today.
Yeah.
So this is the story, the Book of Longings is the story of a girl who becomes a woman in a society that, as we've referenced, is profoundly patriarchal. Tell us about Anna and her longings.
Oh, Anna was filled with longings. And her aunt told her, you know, women's hearts are full of longings, men's hearts are full of God's commands. That sounds about right. Sometimes, because women didn't have the freedom to pursue things like men did, they didn't have room for anything but longings, I guess. And Anna was no exception. She longed to be a scribe and a writer. She was way ahead of her time. She had an acute sense of justice and longing to have the freedom her brother had, her father had, men had. And she basically wanted to have a voice in the world.
And she sees the act of writing as a sacred thing. And there is throughout the book a deep marriage, I'd say, of the sacred or of spirituality with the longing to have an individual voice and creativity, I guess you could say. I wonder if you could connect this, how you develop that in the book.
Well, that is actually a deeply held thought or belief or feeling that I have about writing and creativity. And I guess I endowed Anna with it. But I have always felt like from the time I started writing in at 30, really, that creativity and spirituality were entwined. And for me, it was always, writing was always a conversation with something deep in myself. You know, I call it the soul. I'm not sure what the right word is, but I do think that we have these inner lives, and that is where our creativity is, our imagination, our, you know, dreaming, just all of this wealth of inner material that we draw on to create. And so I have this conversation with that the best I can. And by that, I mean trying to just make a portal to that place and tap it and draw upon it. That feels spiritual to me. And it feels like a prayer. And I guess that is the idea that Anna has too.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with novelist Sue Monk Kidd about her latest novel, The Book of Longings. And of course, in a culture like hers, it would have been. I mean, everything is seen through the lens of religion, so it's very apt in the book. It feels completely right. She has this object, the incantation bowl, which kind of contains, I guess, the deepest longings of her soul. This was a real thing that you discovered. Tell us about the incantation bowl and its role in this wonderful novel, The Book of Longings.
Oh, I was so excited when I discovered this. I stumbled on it on the internet one day when I was completely down a rabbit hole. You know how that is. You don't know how you got on this particular site, and there you are 2 hours later. And I looked at the screen, and there were all of these ancient bowls, some of them 2,000 and 3,000 years old. And they were called incantation bowls. And Jewish women particularly would write prayers inside these bowls in a kind of spiraling way around and around the bowl, and sometimes place a drawing at the bottom. They wrote prayers in them. They wrote curses in them. They wrote warnings, or, you know, all kinds of things. But I decided that Anna should have a bowl, and that it would be a concrete kind of visible thing that would hold these longings, which were so abstract. And I think if you have something like a longing or a want or a motivation for your character, it needs to have a certain feeling of visibility and reality for the reader, you know, not just some floating abstraction. And so that became the icon of her longings. And I loved it because she had to prepare it and write in it, and it was very dear to her. And she was forced to really think through what she wanted to ask for.
And what she asks for is a voice. And this is an incantation bowl. Is this what she wrote? Is this something that she would have then spoken as an incantation?
I think so. I don't know for sure. I couldn't find evidence, but it certainly, the name certainly implies it, that they are canting something. So I imagined her moving the bowl in a circle as she read this prayer and kind of sending it out and sort of singing the words. So it became a ritual for her too.
One of the writings that you put in at her hand, Anna's hand, is an actual writing, The Thunder, Perfect Mind. This is another actual document that you discovered. Tell us about this.
This is a text, an ancient document that was dug up with the Nag Hammadi text in 1945 in Egypt. And that's where all of these Gnostic Gospels were discovered. And one of them happened to be something called The Thunder, Perfect Mind. And I've been reading that particular poem, really, for many years and just love it because it's complex and brilliant and gender bending and all, and really sort of, well, just an amazing piece of work. It's written in the voice of a woman, something, a divine feminine figure. And it's a statement, I think, of identity, of self-revelation. So I loved it, and I just decided that in the end, Anna would have to culminate all of this longing into something very particular, and this would be her opus. And I decided to let her be the author of it, because the author of this document is unknown and was at the same time period that Anna lived, and she's in Egypt at the time. And so it just sort of coincided. And I did it, I said, because it just made me happy to do it.
It's wonderful. And speaking of Egypt, I mean, Egypt is the realm of the goddess as opposed to Galilee, which is the realm of the god. And you cite a lot of the action in the book in Egypt. And before we go into the love story of Jesus and Anna, tell us about the Therapeute community, both in the book and in history.
Yes, I stumbled on that in a footnote. And it sounded interesting. So I looked it up, and lo and behold, it was this amazing kind of proto-monastery-like community. But it was Jewish, pre-Christian, of course. And it was right outside of Alexandria, Egypt. It was connected to the philosopher Philo. And it had both men and women in it. And they were a community of philosophers who were committed to keeping alive the memory of God. And they wrote and they practiced this allegorical interpretation of scriptures. I mean, it was a rather ascetic place in reality. And so I incorporated it into the novel as a place of belonging for Anna.
Belonging, a place of belonging where she could finally realize her longings.
Yes. She would need a place to be. And I foreshadowed from the beginning kind of where that was going to be. And she indeed finds this place and has created for herself the place where she can bring forth what she calls her largeness. I guess she went to the end of her longings there and found what she was looking for all along.
Now, this book is in part a love story. First, tell us about Jesus and how you portrayed him. And was it a struggle to kind of find a way to portray him? Or what were the issues that you dealt with in trying to bring him out as a character?
Writing Jesus was definitely a challenge. I mean, is there anyone on the planet who we know more about or that has more impact in people's lives? And I mean, it was daunting to think about trying to write his character and put words in his mouth. So I had to get over that. I mean, I did stay up a few nights over that one. But in the end, I was very compelled to do this story. And so I decided to write the character of Jesus as a human being, to focus on his humanity, which felt right to me. I didn't want to write the book as a religious person. I wanted to write it as a novelist. And for me, that meant the historical Jesus. I was interested in what he would be like at 19 or 20 or 22. Was he married before he began a public ministry? A lot of people think he was. And how did he evolve into this extraordinary figure? What led up to all of that? And I wanted to find those lost years, you know, when we don't have any record of him, and see what I could create in those in that time that would be consistent with what we know about the historical Jesus.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Sue Monk Kidd about her latest novel, The Book of Longings. You portray him, I mean, in many ways, he and Anna, they both have a mission, and their mission, both of their missions are outside the expectations of their society, as are they. Now, for Anna, one can understand her longings clearly set against the expectations of her society, but it's harder for for a man to be enlightened, although maybe not so hard for Jesus to be enlightened. You know, he does not follow the accepted norms of how to treat his wife, or indeed how to treat any people who are seen as on the margin.
Well, that's right. He was definitely set apart. And I wanted to portray him that way, as well as portray Anna that way. I mean, they, in the book, they have a great love. I mean, they clearly love each other, which I wanted to do, to portray their marriage that way. Although there is conflict in it, it is a human marriage. But they also had these individual aspirations that were powerful inside of them, that were evolving. With Anna, it was much more clearer from the beginning what her longing was and what she wanted to do, and she was thwarted at it. Jesus had doubts in my version about whether this was his calling, whether God had this mission for him, and he came to it. And Anna feared it, frankly. I think she called it his everything and her everything. And eventually those everythings would separate them in some way.
I very much read this book, maybe because I'm a kind of rebel, that it's a book about rebellions against injustice. And it's very clearly Anna, of course, rebels against the strictures placed upon women. But you develop really Jesus as a revolutionary, and you go into the history of the time. I wonder if you could talk about, you know, him as a revolutionary, first politically against Roman rule, and then secondarily how he developed the idea, his revolutionary idea, to encompass so much more than that.
Yeah. Well, once I decided that I would portray what I thought of from the scholar Marcus Borg, the pre-Easter Jesus, the human Jesus, the real flesh and blood one. Once I got that very firmly, that was my course, I wanted then to show what an extraordinary human being he really was, what his vision was, because it was revolutionary. I mean, right in the beginning, when Anna and Jesus have their first real conversation, Anna says something like, in their religion, God was pure, therefore they should be pure. And that really was the undergirding of first century Judaism. It was the purity of God and the purity of his people. For Jesus, she says, it was God is love, not God is pure. God is love, therefore we must be loving. So that was an act of, that was very different. It was also a radical departure to think that God dwelled outside the temple. But they both saw this divine spirit spilling out of the temple everywhere. And one of Anna's great, I guess you call it, she blurts this out, a kind of statement that makes Jesus laugh, and yet he's intrigued by it. She says, why should we confine God in these narrow expectations? Why don't we free God? And he said, free God. I think that would be interesting to hear about. So he learns from her and she learns from him, and they're very much alike in many ways and different in other ways.
And we haven't yet mentioned that Anna has a brother, an adopted brother, who just happens to be Judas. And he's a very interesting figure, too, because tell us about him. Tell us about Judas. And you know, we all know the ultimate role that he played in the story. But you, for the first, you know, I've always wondered, why did Judas betray Jesus? And you come up with a pretty convincing theory about it.
Well, I did want to offer an idea of how complex that must have been for him. I portrayed it as a piece of both political theater and a piece of, let's say, human woundedness. I mean, he was a wounded little boy in my story who at the hands of the Romans who occupied that land. And he grew up wanting his revenge. So that was a big part of it for him. And the other part was he was very politically motivated. He was a zealot, and they fought with the sword for freedom from Rome. So those two things were very dominant in him, and they grew and grew to a climax about it in which he betrays Jesus. So I did try to fill in some blanks with that.
Yeah, and it comes down to, you know, it comes down to the age-old controversy, I guess you say, between nonviolent change and violent overthrow, violent change. I mean, these, you know, we're still dealing with it. And this, you know, what struck me so much is, you know, we're still fighting the same battles against oppression, and the way of love, let's say the way of Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, versus maybe the way of, I don't know, maybe, you know, the Nation of Islam. I mean, I wouldn't want to say Malcolm X because he evolved towards the latter part of his life. But this was very much in play during the civil rights movement. And it's in play today, I guess, any time that you have an implacable, you know, ruling class that is oppressing people.
Yes, yes, it's still a conflict. And I wanted actually to play that out to some extent in the story. Jesus was a nonviolent resistor. He portrayed a kind of resistance against the political ruling party that was both passionate but nonviolent. And it is reminiscent of Gandhi and of Martin Luther King, who adapted that kind of technique. And I think Judas was the opposite. I mean, he believed that they would change nothing unless they did it through violence. But Jesus, and this is not just my vision of Jesus. It's based on the pictures of him in many of the New Testament stories that scholars feel like have authenticity to his history, actually. They're all about trying to find the actual Jesus, you know, what he really said, what he really did, what you can, and they have all kind of methodologies to do that. And it is interesting stuff. But he had a vision of what he called God's kingdom. And he was all about that. I mean, bringing in God's kingdom. And he envisioned it as this table of inclusion where everyone's invited, the least of these were invited, and the vulnerable, the left out, the invisible. So he was for the little guy, the poor. And he just was all about compassion, but he also wanted to free his people from the oppression of Rome and the oppression of some aspects of his religion that had been oppressive to people and the government of Herod Antipas. So he was political. He was a social prophet. And he was an evolving deliverer in the end.
So finally, Sue Monk Kidd, you have said that one central question that drove you in writing this novel, The Book of Longings, was how would the Western world be different if Jesus did have a wife who had been part of the narrative all along down through the centuries? What do you think?
I think it would be very different. I have thought about this some, and I'm sure I don't have all the answers here, but I do feel like it would have impacted the role of women considerably. If we had had a story of his wife, and she had been a genuine partner and involved and a participant at his side, I feel like women's stories would have been more inclusive. Their roles of leadership may not have been so easily marginalized. There would be more valuing of women. I also think we probably wouldn't have celibacy in the priesthood. I mean, there would be no precedent for that. And, you know, that breach we were talking about earlier between sexuality and sensuality, or what is sacred and what is not sacred, nature, for instance, that breach probably would not be quite so vast, because it really has a profound impact on the history, Western history, even today. So I don't know. I'm sure there are other things. I've probably only scratched the surface, but that's what's coming to me.
Yes, and I agree with you. I mean, I'm just, as you were speaking, I was imagining all kinds of things. I mean, the other day, you know, I heard a Trump person scream at somebody, you know, how can you be a Christian if you don't support abortion? And I always say, how can you be a Christian if you are not filled with compassion for those who are other or marginalized?
Yeah. It's a very polarized world right now. So I think we could use some, dialogue, some listening, some understanding. I wish I had the answer. I wish somebody would come up with one, because it's really a serious divisiveness in our culture now.
Yes, I agree. And I also agree that, you know, the answer does lie very much in you know, Jesus' message of love. And I say that as someone who's not a Christian. I grew up, I'm Jewish. My father was a rabbi. But it is that message of love as opposed to judgment that I think is really the most revolutionary thing that he did. And I wish we all could follow that.
Well, you know, Jesus was thoroughly Jewish, and I was determined to portray Jesus that way. He was a man of his time and place and religion. I mean, he was Jewish, even though he was dissident in a lot of ways, revolutionary, as you said. He could step outside the box and was pretty brave and courageous about what he would say would get him in trouble. And ultimately, it got him killed. But I felt, here are some things that have been gratifying to me. There are some readers who are a little nervous about reading the novel because Jesus gets married. And that's such a scary idea for them, I guess. So they often will say in comments to me this very thing, and then they will say, but I took a chance and I read it, and oh, I'm so glad I did, because I rediscovered Jesus all over again. And I kind of fell in love with him again, because we've been on the outs for, you know, 20 years or something. And I think that that title of a book that I have here on my shelf is called Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time. I think some readers are actually doing that. I mean, I hasten to say to follow this up, because we talked a lot about Jesus. While he is a very significant character in this book, this is really Anna's story. And it's her, not just the story of her marriage, though that is part of her story. It is the story of her own quest and her largeness. And I think that they are twined together for a while, but it's really her story. And not writing as a religious person helped me to have enough space and non-familiarity in a way to really write this story in a different way. And, you know, I grew up, you said you were Jewish and a rabbi's daughter. I grew up in a little town in the South, in Georgia, where there were two churches, the Baptist and the Methodist. And we happened to belong to the Baptist, because this was all there was. There was no diversity. And there was one Jewish family in town. That was it. So, you know, in many ways, I had a long way to go to come to terms with my religion and my world. But I eventually left institutional Christianity, though I do have a very deep spiritual life. And in a way, writing this novel, I kind of fell in love with the human Jesus again. So, you know, it was his message and his teachings, and I just tried to portray him as playful, as humorous, but as deeply connected to God.
Yes, and I'm so glad you said that also. I mean, all of that, but that this book really is on a story, and it is, you know, she wants a voice. You give her the voice, and through it, I mean, she's not the only female figure in the book. There are many others that are also wonderful characters, and they are all strong women who are fighting basically for that same thing, fighting for a voice, fighting for their creativity, fighting for their, what is the word that you use? Their largeness.
Yes.
Yeah, that it is such a wonderful novel. Sue Monk Kidd, thank you so much for talking with us here about The Book of Longings.
Oh, I have enjoyed it very much. Thank you for having me.
Sue Monk Kidd. Read an excerpt from The Book of Longings by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, The Criminalization of Black Girls by Systemic Racism in the Schools. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We first aired our interview with Monique Morris in 2016, soon after the murder of Philando Castile at the hands of the police. Now, as protests against police violence sweep the land, we thought it would be a good time to re-air that interview about Morris's book, Push Out. It's about another aspect of systemic racism, the criminalization of black girls in schools. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The tragic toll of police violence on the lives of young black men has been much in the news lately. But there's another slow-motion tragedy that we hear very little about, the disproportionate numbers of black girls being pushed out of school and into the prison pipeline. Their lives are also being destroyed by zero-tolerance policies, racist indifference to their educational needs, and an epidemic of sexual assault. Take the case of 15-year-old Diamond. She stopped going to school when she was expelled for lashing out at peers who constantly teased her for something everyone on the staff had missed. She was being trafficked for sex. After months on the run, she was arrested and sent to a detention center for violating a court order to attend school. That's just one of many stories social justice scholar Monique Morris unearthed over 4 years of research for her book, Push Out. It chronicles the experience of black girls across the country whose lives are misunderstood by teachers, administrators, and the justice system, and degraded by the very institutions charged with helping them flourish. Yet, despite these obstacles, black girls still find ways to breathe remarkable dignity into their lives in classrooms, juvenile facilities, and beyond. Morris gives voice to them and charts the path towards nourishing these children instead of throwing them away. Well, Monique Morris, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me on.
This book, Push Out, is such an important book, pointing to an issue that really is underreported in the media, the criminalization of black girls in schools, and that is your subtitle of the book. In the first pages of the book, you list a couple of cases that made it, that did make it into the media.
Mm-hmm.
In 2013, a 16-year-old diabetic girl in Alabama fell asleep during an in-school suspension, was ordered to leave the classroom, and as she was leaving, a police officer slammed her face into a file cabinet, and she got arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are black girls as young as 6 or 7 who are arrested for throwing tantrums in kindergarten. How typical are cases like this, and how do they signal the systematic push out of black girls from schools?
Thank you for framing that in that way. You know, I think it's very easy for us to look at some of the most egregious cases involving school push-out or the use of exclusionary discipline, the suspensions, the expulsions, and the violence enacted against girls, you know, as something that either does not occur often or that is so anomalous that we can disregard it. And, you know, I put them in the book and I string them together because it's important for us to understand that while they do represent, you know, an egregious enactment, so they're not super typical, you know, to have girls assaulted in this way consistently every day. But they do occur, and they occur among black girls more often than they occur among other girls. And also, they signal, you know, when I talk about school-to-confinement pathways or what most people understand to be the school-to-prison pipeline, you know, I talk about not just the policies and practices that facilitate this school push-out and criminalization that occurs in schools, but I also talk about a prevailing consciousness that does render girls, black girls in particular, vulnerable to the type of punishment, the type of violent and sexual victimization that renders them vulnerable to contact with the criminal and juvenile legal system later in life. So these cases, while they do stand out, you know, sort of in the public, or they have been able to reach the masses, if you will, in a way that allows people to understand what might be happening in schools, they are a signal in many ways of the prevailing consciousness. They're a reflection of the consciousness that has rendered black girls vulnerable to this type of abuse in schools, as well as to the erasure of their experiences in the public discourses about safety.
So say more about that consciousness. How are black girls perceived by the dominant culture?
Yeah, it's not even just by the dominant culture. So I talk a bit in the book about, you know, I sort of build on W.E.B. Du Bois's articulation of black identity through this concept of double consciousness, which he wrote about in 1903. And he talks a bit about how black people have always needed to struggle with reconciling their identity as black people as well as Americans. And what I offer in this space, really drawing from the scholarship, the, you know, radical black feminist scholarship around identity, is understanding too that gender is a third identity that never goes away. It's one that's extremely visible, and it's one in its you know, sort of representation publicly that informs how black women are engaged and black girls are engaged by the public. So, you know, in the public mind, there is, you know, or in the sort of a collective consciousness, there's this way in which black femininity is presented as hypersexual or loud, sassy, conniving, and these are ideas that inform how adults engage with girls. And when girls are not behaving in a manner that is consistent with some of our normed ideas about what constitutes a good girl, quote unquote, you know, black girls in particular are vulnerable to a type of punishment and discipline that really does present them with the possibility of being pushed out of school. And that's what I'm interrogating here, especially given how important it is for girls to stay in school if we want to maintain them as a community that has a reduced contact with the criminal and juvenile legal system. Having an education reduces the likelihood of being in contact with the justice system in significant ways. And so if we know that, why are we trying to push girls out?
Tell us now, how did you get interested in this? It's a very passionately written book. It's a wonderful book and a powerful one. So how did you get involved in this issue?
Much of it was informed by my own consciousness, just having been at one time a black girl, now a black woman, and understanding the public gaze and the way in which black femininity was misunderstood by the public and misunderstood by adults who were in educational positions. But really what I noticed, really in the mid-1990s, when I was engaging in conversations about criminalization and advancing my own education, I noticed that, number one, most of the conversations that were happening about youth in the justice system were focused primarily on boys. Mm-hmm. And that while that was reflective of their dominance in institutions, they are absolutely overrepresented in carceral facilities, there was always a girls' wing, and there was always a group of girls who were in these facilities and whose needs were not necessarily being met. And about 15 years ago, actually almost 16 years ago now, I had written a street novel that looked at prostitution, and it told a fictional story about very real issues in our communities, about girls who were commercially sex trafficked. And I had the opportunity to go in and talk to some of the young girls and older girls in facilities. And in one facility in particular, there was a very, very young girl. I talk about her in the book, you know, who really just woke me up. And it's not that I was asleep, because I definitely saw the girls that were in there, but she was so young. She was 11 years old and had already been commercially sex trafficked. And the way that she referred to herself and the absence of any rigorous discussion about re-engaging her in school was just heartbreaking. And so I think it's been very important in our, you know, public consciousness to bring attention to the forgotten needs of girls. And the more I have seen conversations emerge and grow about interrupting the school-to-prison pipeline, I started to notice, along with several other colleagues, that we needed to bring girls intentionally into this space if we were actually going to interrupt these cycles, given that they are sharing the surveillance, sharing schools, sharing the criminalization alongside many boys. So that is really what brought me into this space.
That 11-year-old, you call her Denisha, so powerful. She introduces herself to you as an 11-year-old and a hoe.
Exactly.
And you go into a lot of the background to it. It's a very, I'd say, a multidimensional treatment that you give on sex trafficking of black girls. First, starting with how black women are viewed as hypersexual, and also talking about all the different factors that push girls, young girls, into prostitution and out of school. I wonder if you could talk about that multifactorial picture now.
You know, I'd like to start in that space by addressing the what I call the priming of black girls for their own victimization. I have now had an opportunity to talk about the book in different cities around the country, and it's very interesting to me how there is still, you know, very much a strong oral tradition in the black community. And there are songs that girls sing on playgrounds and yards, and it, you know, follows the patty cake rhythms and, you know, the sort of playful ways in which girls share and exchange information. And, you know, one of the things that I offer at the beginning of each chapter is a little epilogue that is an excerpt from some of those songs. And there are many ways in which the songs themselves reflect an internalized oppression and an internalized way in which girls understand that at some point in their lives they may have to sell their bodies, or they may be requested to interrogate their own opportunity to live and grow. And these are the things that, you know, I think are part of the reflection of their own identities, or the part that I really want to interrogate. So the idea that, you know, their girls are singing songs that prime them to get ready for their own victimization is certainly part of it. But there's also another piece. There is the way in which the behaviors, the pain, the exploitation, the sexual victimization of black girls really floats under the radar for much of the public. And while we might see girls engaged in commercial sexual exploitation or being victimized in some ways, there's this tendency, given the legacy and stereotyping associated with black sexuality, black feminine sexual expressions especially, that says, okay, these girls are choosing to participate in this life, right? These girls aren't trafficked. That happens on the global sphere. That doesn't happen domestically. And so I'm challenging that, because these girls are absolutely trafficked, and they are not choosing to participate in this life, and they are trying the best they can to really reconcile many oppressions that invade their lives and strip away their childhoods. And in schools, we tend to see them show up primarily as truants, and, you know, sort of engage them as if they are rule breakers and violators of law, instead of engaging with them at the point of their victimization status. And that's the piece that I want to, you know, really uplift and engage as we talk about the particular vulnerabilities of girls who are pushed out. And I include them here not as a niche population. I include them here pretty centrally, because girls who have a history of sexual victimization, commercial exploitation, these girls are at highest risk of school push-out. And, you know, our failure to address their needs is associated with our failure to address school push-out. and especially among girls who are at high risk.
Yeah, I mean, the whole notion that an 11, 12, 13, or 14-year-old could even choose to do this,
even
if they think they... you imagine if these were white girls, or even, not even white middle-class girls, but white girls, there would be an uproar.
Right. And, you know, really thinking about, you know, our girls not as throwaway children. I don't believe in throwaway children. I've said that in many different spaces, and in many ways, these girls have been our forgotten daughters. We, you know, see them in passing, or we just kind of disregard them as not wanting to participate, and it's a really irresponsible way that we have engaged them, especially when you think about schools as mandatory reporting agencies, and, you know, our failure to respond to them is really just unconscionable. So, in that sense, they are center. they are center to this work to me.
You also go into policies that contribute to, that have greatly contributed to this push out of black girls from school, policies of zero tolerance, for example, and you link zero tolerance with a broken windows policing. So define the two of them and how they are linked.
Yeah, so the broken windows theory is really the philosophy in policing that if one addresses some of the smaller infractions, that they can prevent the larger infractions from occurring, or the more serious offenses from occurring. And zero tolerance policies really grew out of a concern for public safety in schools that are really about removing students from schools based upon a set of predetermined mandatory actions that follow negative student behavior. In many ways, you know, the zero tolerance policies were designed to respond to the growing rates of violence that were being recorded in schools, largely associated with guns or drugs. But what has occurred, given the hyper-punitive nature of much of our discipline orientation over the past 20 years, is that kids who have, engaged in behaviors that might have historically resulted in, you know, maybe a very serious discussion and intervention and dealing with root causes, now, you know, leads to their removal from school without any serious way of intervening or discussing what happens or resolving conflict in a meaningful way. Many schools are beginning to rethink their commitment to zero tolerance policies, given the growing body of research that has shown how little it actually has a positive impact on addressing student conflict, but there are still too many schools that do rely on zero tolerance policing, zero tolerance engagement with students, where there really is little to no room for students to make a mistake without being sent home or removed from school. This plays out in the life of girls in different ways. Number one, if girls are in a fight, in a physical altercation, they're often sent home on a mandatory suspension or a mandatory, you know, depending on the number of fights, expulsion, without there really being an interrogation of why these girls are engaged in the behaviors that they're engaged in. I don't in any way excuse the fighting that occurs, the physical violence that occurs in schools, but I'm also very clear that violence is something that we need to address together. And so when we talk about safety, I challenge the idea that safety is something that has to be implemented. In my mind, safety is co-constructed with the group that needs to be safe. And that means having conversations with girls about what is making them feel unsafe. So in the book, I uplift the narratives of girls who have been fighters, who are struggling, you know, with safety, and in some ways who have internalized the idea that they need to fight, quote-unquote, in order to be safe in schools. And among those girls, when you dig a little deeper, of course you find that they are struggling with their own victimization, that they have learned that violence is the way that you respond to negative conflict, and that they feel that they're not listened to or heard in other ways. And, you know, it's interesting because in some of the early conversations that I was having with girls in the Northeast, we'd ask girls, I was in a focus group with a colleague of mine, Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a professor and scholar in these spaces around intersectionality, and she said, and we were sitting around a group of girls, and we recognized that not only did the girls have difficulty centering themselves in conversations about fighting in schools and school-to-confinement pathways, but that they, in many ways, were demonstrating and sharing that they felt they needed to act up and act, quote-unquote, like the boys if they were going to be seen and responded to, if their needs were going to be met by the school. That was the only way they could become visible, was if they were fighting. And, you know, that to us, you know, just was jarring in so many ways to understand that one has to behave in a hyper-aggressive way in order to be seen is deeply problematic. And so that is, you know, again, why I spend so much time talking about the victimization of black girls and our inability to see it and respond to it outside of these spaces, and the need for schools to do so in order for us to really move past some of the, you know, sort of, you know, very peripheral ways in which we're engaging with black girls at the moment.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Monique Morris about her terrific book, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. And I like your phrase, uplift their narrative, because you give the reader the perspective that in some ways, I mean, yeah, it may be inappropriate, it may be overblown, but in some ways it is within a tradition of black resistance to oppression.
Yeah, in some ways it very much is. You know, these girls in many ways are managing multiple oppressions, and they don't use that language, but I certainly see it. And what they do is just talk about fairness. And in their own words, they'll talk about feeling treated differently. They'll point to, you know, differential engagement. And, you know, I recognize these as structures of oppression and their resistance to it. So the practice in particular of speaking out when they feel something is wrong, or the tradition of challenging something that they feel is unjust, you know, it's really, you know, a way that they have come to understand their own particular voice. And then, you know, when they are engaged in the practice of doing it, they get into trouble again. And so that part for them in their young minds is very confusing. It's not particularly confusing to those of us who understand and study structures of oppression and understand that, you know, any act of resistance to oppression may be met with some alternate, you know, form of trying to suppress it. But at the same time, you know, for the girls who are trying to speak out and who are trying to learn how to be effective in their own spaces and navigate through these structures, you know, it can be very confusing and very disheartening. And so for many, they choose just not to come to school, and that quote-unquote choice is really a false one. It's one that is rooted in the adults pushing them away from school by not engaging them as whole people and as whole students. And so, you know, I think there are definitely ways that we can begin to respond to this and address the implicit and explicit ways in which our own adult biases are impacting young people's learning and development.
That was Monique Morris talking with us in 2016 about her book, Push Out. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest of that interview. And make sure you go to writersvoice.net to see some of our summer reading recommendations. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.